Manx Radio has been broadcasting the TT races for 6 decades, but in times past it was very much the ingenuity of enthusiastic staff that got the information on air. The equipment used was on occasion begged and borrowed. One man who was there at the start was engineer Charlie Webster, while Jeff Cannell wasn't too far behind. Blue smoke very fast are their recollections of what went and what didn't go on air. David Collister jogged their collection of recollections.
We weren't allowed into the grandstand. We were completely barred by the BBC and the ACU. And we weren't allowed in the grandstand, so we borrowed the large green commentary box, which was used a Timmel in those days, double-decker, and we put that alongside the cemetery. And we were in there. Stuart Lord did the commentary from Ballacraine, and it was an awful commentary position. He was in the pub. And he said to me, how would I know when the riders were coming? I said, well, watch the BBC chap pick his lip mic up. And when he picks his up, they're on their way. And then we had a commentary, well, we had a van, I think, at Balaf on the forecourt of the garage on the left-hand side there, which is another awful commentary position. You couldn't see anything. And then we had Ian Cannell up at the bungalow, highest point on the course.
What were you just timekeeping then? Or what
no, no, I was engineering then.
You were engineering?
I put all the equipment out.
So what did you... Oh, I see, you put the equipment out. What else did you have to do during the course of the race itself then?
Well, you just had to be on hand in case anything went wrong, in case the transmitters would go off at Foxdale, which, I mean, they weren't 100% reliable in those days. So we'd go out in the morning, first thing, about 6:30, go up to the bungalow. I can always remember, I don't think you see it now, but years and years ago then, I mean, senior race day, there was hundreds of people walking up Hillbury,
yeah,
you know. So we used to put the equipment in there because we had no talkback or anything. So,
oh, what? How did you communicate?
Well, it was very difficult, really. Eventually, borrowed a couple of handsets, telephone handsets from the post office. Had a little battery, and you used to put it on. You go, and hope that you would have his the other end, and you'd hear him.
You would be the engineer at the grandstand,
yeah. Yes. And then you'd go down through Felty Will, then to Balaf.
So presumably, from the broadcast point of view, the programme was controlled by the main presenter, Peter Neal.
Peter Neal, yes, he was the anchor.
So everybody picked up their cues from him?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. What was you told me once about having a whole load of pennies or something. What was that?
Well, he asked for volunteers on your day off to go up to the bungalow, and I was given something like £5 worth of pennies from Peter, and a stopwatch, and an AA key. And it was my job to go up to the bungalow, and it was Haywood, and I think there was Jaco Agostini, there was all the big riders. It was my job to time them going through, and then rush to the AA box and say, Haywood's gone through, Agostini's 10 seconds down, Phil Reed is 25 seconds down, put the money in button A and button
B. Oh, you had
B.
to put the pennies in
oh,
the
I
box?
Oh, I put an A button B, yeah, into the grandstand, and then run out of gauge. I think my pocket and my trousers, I think it must have gone about 6 inches longer when I started.
Well, he didn't tell you he kept half the pennies.
Jeff, you started, I think you had told me, as a timekeeper then, did you?
Yes, I went out to Ballacraine, by which time they'd had a proper commentary box put up there on scaffolding. Quite a way up. In fact, Heinz Rosner managed to hit it one morning practice and brought the whole lot down. And many said it's a pity that we weren't in it at the time. But, yeah, that was all right there. It was a bit difficult to get into the box, though. You had to get up on a wall and then sort of across the top of a hedge and leap in through the back of it. And that was 1968 timekeeping for Jack Cretney. And 68, 69 and 70, which were the 3 years I did at Ballacraine timekeeping, were fantastically hot. So hot that it was 100 degrees in the box, and you had to have the back door closed because there were speakers outside which would feed back.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't do your mental arithmetic on the times because it was so hot. As soon as you opened the door and the air came in, you could go back to normal service. So I did that, and then in 1970, the last race was the senior, and there'd been, I think, a 125 race in the morning, and Jack's voice went, and they rang from the grandstand and said, give Jeff a go, because I'd already, of course, done the 69 Manx Grand Prix at the bungalow, so they knew I could do the stuff, but to be chucked into the senior race was a thrill for me, but I got through. And one thing I do remember is that Agostini was winning, and he came round Ballacraine and the machine coughed a bit, and I said, sounds like one of the carburettors is a bit out of adjustment. And I was very pleased when he said at the end, well, I wasn't able to go quite as quick as normal because one of the carburettors was out of adjustment. So
yeah, but you had to be a motorcyclist to know that.
You did, yeah.
What were the toilet facilities at these commentary positions around the course? And presumably at Ballacrane you could get into the pub, could you?
The people that had the private house nearby were very kind of Max Radio, and in fact they fed and watered them. And there was a story about Jack where he went into the bathroom to wash his face, Charlie, wasn't there?
Jack, he used to go up every lunchtime and clean his teeth. But they forgot to tell him that the plumber had been and disconnected the pipe. And Jack was busy cleaning his teeth and singing and washing his hands. And we were all sitting downstairs in the kitchen. And this water kept coming through the ceiling through the floorboards. It was Jack. But he is same as lots of blue smoke, very fast.
Jack Crittenden is a family friend of ours, actually.
Yeah.
He was in the RAF and he had a silver, a chromium plate in his skull. Mm. He'd broken his skull. And his skull bones were held together with this chromium plate. But he was a great character, especially in the local theatrical productions.
Yes, that's right.
Then he did JJ Productions, which was Jack and Joyce, his wife. I think they lost hundreds, really, but they were so enthusiastic. But Jack was good fun, but he didn't really know all that much about the bikes beyond what Charlie says, which is clouds of blue smoke and very fast, and we forgot so-and-so going through. But it was all part of it in those days.
Who were the other commentators in the early days then?
Well, it was, what was his name, Lease, wasn't it?
Ken Lease.
Ken Lease.
Yeah.
And Ian Cannell.
Ian Cannell.
Well, of course, Ian was with it for a long time, wasn't he?
He was with Colburn, of course, wasn't he?
Was he?
Yeah.
Well, Colburn's actually put a pretty good system out to start with, long before Manx Radio, and it was very comprehensive. They had about 10 commentary points. They were all over the show.
Yeah.
And, of course, you'd have the BBC doing it as well. David Lay, you know, and the crip voice.
That's right.
Clipped voice, Bertie Reed and people like that. But it was very Ken Wolstenholme, very precise, and here comes
now. But it was only intermittent, wasn't it? It wasn't a continuous commentary, I don't think.
Well, Colburn's was, I think.
I think it was Colburn's.
Was it?
Yeah.
Round the course commentary.
Yes.
It was very, very far before
and
its
that
time.
Was used by John Grierson for the very first coverage that Manx Radio had. It's the only way they could cover it in 1964.
Yeah, they came to an arrangement with Coley and picked up his feed, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah.
People like Dolan Kelly were out at Sulby. But
it wasn't very good commentary, because I remember being at Fox and Lanes at the time, and we just got a new big stereo radiogram, and this chap would come on and say, in the lead is number 17, followed by number 16 and number 32.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know who they were. They didn't have a programme.
But that must have been one of the difficulties for commentators, because there's not a lot of time between looking to see which number 37 is and so on.
Well, once you get used to it, you don't need to, of course.
No.
You know them by sight. But the Manx Grand Prix is different. You need to look at the programme. But it is an art which you can do by averting your gaze, same as when you're doing anything else on a microphone you can read at the same time. But one of the problems, of course, in those days was that the fast riders weren't always at the front. Nowadays, the fast men are all in the top 30 riders.
Mm.
But then they used to be spread throughout the field, so you could have number 2 leading the race and number 99 running second, and of course there wasn't enough time on air at the points to get them all through.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was always running Fulnacular, you know, and but it was all right for the time with what equipment there was knowledge there was.
It was fairly primitive, Charlie, wasn't it, when you think about it now? The commentary points and the way that you communicate, if you were lucky to communicate, I suppose. Really.
Oh, yes. You know, I mean, sometimes if our little handsets didn't work, used to get you and say to the phone up here and say, the bungalow seems to be working okay up there, the engineers up at the bungalow, and you knew then that everything was working.
Right.
Yeah, the commentators couldn't talk back to the grandstand except live on air.
Mm. Yeah.
They could talk to you and say 20 seconds in your headphones, but you couldn't talk to them except when you were broadcasting live. And that made it very difficult until you had two-way talk back off air.
You also had the situation as a commentator where they'd hand over to you and expecting a certain rider to come through and he hadn't appeared and you had to fill out and pad out, didn't you? That was never a difficulty for you.
Jeff was a master at that.
Yes.
I mean, now when I listen to the commentary now, I mean, this other chap who's doing it, I mean, if there's a five-minute delay, he seems to hand back to the studio because he ain't got a clue.
Well, anybody can talk when there's lots of things happening. The trick is to fill in and try and make it sound interesting. And that was one of the things that happened when my services were dispensed with, really. So many people said to me, that's what we're missing, is the fill-ins. And yet I thought when I was doing them, people would say, there's Cannell rabbiting on again. But you've got to say something. You can't have dead air. and at Palaf Bridge with a Formula 3 race, it would be 8 minutes before the riders got to the bungalow. Well, there'd only be 20 riders in it, so they'd long gone through Palaf, the last one of those, and we never quite got round to describing the seagulls flying around, but it wasn't far off at times.
Talking about Palaf, I mean, George Lehman, the landlord of the pub, when we moved into the, we eventually moved into the pub, in his lounge, upstairs in the lounge, and he used to hit the bottle. He was all right in the morning first thing, George, but come lunchtime, he was pretty, wasn't
K-lied.
He? K-lied. He'd come upstairs just before, I remember just before the race started, and he came and then he came into the living room and said, "What are you fellas doing in my living room?" And you were trying to push him out.
Yeah, it was in his own lounge, which is very kind of him, really. And when there were postponements, of course, you were lying around for hours out there in his living room. And then, of course, he would start up on the electric organ downstairs, which gave a novel twist to the commentary. And he would have the horse racing on full blast on the television as well.
Did we pick that up on air as well?
Well, you could hear it in the background.
In the background,
it was all part
of
the fun of it. I used to actually give the horse racing results out just to fill in. But you couldn't see that much because it was a great view of the bikes coming down to Palaf. They jumped the bridge and then you didn't know what happened to them. Well, if anybody's going to crash at Palaf, it's after they've taken the bridge. But you couldn't see where that place was, what had happened to them. You just had to wait and see if the marshals were running.
Yeah.
But then we moved up further on the old cottage site there, right on the bridge, and boy, was that hairy. People said I wouldn't stand there for a big clock, and in those days I used to say, it'll be all right, but now I wouldn't go there.
Uh-huh.
You're right in the firing line.
Yeah.
And of course, there were a couple of bad incidents.
The amazing thing is, if you look at old photographs of the races, you'll often see spectators almost right on the edge of the side of the road, wouldn't you, as well? And that must have still happened in the 60s, I guess.
Yes, there was always chaps on that roundabout, Governor's Bridge on the corner.
Yeah.
No matter what time of day you went up, there'd be somebody sitting there, wouldn't there?
You don't, because the chap who owns it won't allow it. He's a chap who just won't allow people to go on one of the most famous places where they did no harm. But a story about that, of course, was that when Jimmy Swindlehurst, the police sergeant, was there, if you went on that inside of the hairpin, he told you before you went, "Now you're there for the day. You aren't coming across the road when you're fed up." And that's right, you were stuck there.
Oh,
and good though it was, after 5 or 6 hours in the rain, the novelty wears off of it. But he would not let anybody cross the road. And then people got the idea then that you could crawl under a gully under Governor's Bridge Dip and then go under the wall and come in from Summer Hill Glen.
Right. Yes, well, you could actually.
Yeah.
That's right.
But they were wonderful days, though, weren't they, in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah. Well, I was at Palaf for 17 years, of course. I mean, I did Ballacraine with Jack for the 70 senior. Then I moved to the bungalow and for the Manx, and did the Manx a couple of years, 3 years up there, I think. And then I established myself. When Ken Leash packed in, I went to Palaf and made that my home for 17 years. And, it was the best place on the course. Always exciting.
Who sort of got together the team of commentators and the timekeepers and everybody that was involved in that?
It was left to me half the time.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
That's why we were never contacted till the night before.
But, there must have been some really hairy times where things went wrong. You see, the listeners don't hear the things that go wrong in the background, do they?
No, well, one of the things that went wrong badly one time was that there was a postponement, and it was so long a postponement that I went home from the grandstand and they said, the next announcement will be at 1:30, the roads will close at 2 and the race will start at 2:30. So about 1:15, I set off for the grandstand, got to St Ninian's and found the road shut. They'd advanced the race by 30 minutes, which was totally illegal because the announcements on Manx Radio carried the full force of a road-closing statutory order. Anyway, they let me across, and I had the hair then all the way up Ingebrek and down Druidale to get to Palaf.
Really?
And the race had started as I was still going down Druidale.
Yeah.
And anyway, I screeched to a halt in the Glen Road at Palaf, ran across, jumped into the box, and they said, "Now to Jeff Cannell," and the bikes were coming down the road.
Really?
Yeah. Whoa. That was tight.
Had you been able to listen to the commentary in your car?
Yes,
away?
I had.
That's
fortunate. That made it worse.
Yeah.
Because
you knew
then how near they were getting to Palaf. They were certainly through Ballacraine while I was still driving down the road at the end of Druidale.
One year, Ewan and I were up at the bungalow, and he couldn't see a hand in front of him. We thought, "It'll never start. It'll never happen today." So we came back down here and had a cup of coffee, locked everything up, you know, made us all secure. And then they said, "Oh, the race will start in 30 minutes." So I think they had to take the window out of the box to get in.
Yeah. And another time I raced down Druidale, I rode in the classic parade in the morning, and then I had to get to Balaf for the race, and I didn't allow myself enough time, and I was still dressed in full racing leathers, driving a mini pickup at about 70 down Druidhill to get there. And I hadn't had anything to eat, and I said on the air, you know, I haven't had a time for lunch. And the ladies from the Methodist Church, who ran a sort of thriving business selling teas and that in the hall nearby, came round. But the trouble was, they came round to the back of the box, and they were hammering on the back door of the commentary box, and we were live on air, and I had my foot against the door, and she was stood outside with sausage and chips and jelly. So eventually, anyway, we dragged this lot in and managed to devour that.
That's an interesting thing, though, Charlie. I mean, these commentators were stuck there all day, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
What happened? Did they get lunch? Did they get drinks? Did they
lunch? You're taking your own sandwiches in your flask. You didn't take them yourself. You've had it, mate.
Yeah.
I used to... At the grandstand, we were quite lucky because I used to go down to the Waverley... Is it the Waverley Chippy?
Yeah.
I used to go down there at lunchtime, get the fish and chips and the mushy peas, and I'd be waiting outside for the Garlingdon to happen. And I mean, as soon as I heard that, I'd go in there and get the chips and everything else and go back and we'd have fish and chips. We were very well looked after in those days.
Yeah.
But if you had the stick, you had it.
Yeah. At the Grand Prix, Cesar Leonetti, the barber, used to come out to Balaf once a year, and it was his... And we would let him sit in the box with it. There was just room for three people, you see. And he would bring a hamper. Well, you know, the Italian salami and cheese and everything. So we got used to this. This was fine. And then for a couple of years, he didn't come. So we used to bring our own sandwiches. That was the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, of course, needless to say, when you're up much earlier than normal, you eat your lunchtime sandwiches about 10 o'clock in the morning. So we'd eaten all these, just finished them all off, and round the corner comes Caesar with a hamper. Would have fed about 20 people. And, of course, we couldn't dare insult him. And Tim O'Hanlon and I think it was. No, it wasn't Tim. It might have been, I don't know, anyway. Yeah. Whatever, we were trying to eat all this stuff of Caesar's on top of what we'd already had as a lunch. We had ended up putting stuff in our pockets and giving up the girls up Druidhill on the way home.
And there's no toilet facilities at the bungalow. I mean, you know, you just had it.
Yeah, at Balaf, you actually had to cross the river to get to Mr. Mundell's house, which was the opposite side of the road. The river was down shallow, you could just jump along like stepping stones. But on bad days, you know, you had to go around the back of the cottage and perform rather than chance splashing through the river. Which reminds me of an incredible thing. When computers first came out, Charles Gard produced this computer, and he said, you don't need stopwatches and all that, you can turn the riders by a computer, all preset. So he turns up with this thing about 20 feet square and hundreds of yards of cable, and then said, where's the power plug? Well, there wasn't one. So he had to put Wellingtons on and feed a great cable under Balaf Bridge and right through to Mr. Mundell's house across the road.
Right. You'd be out for the early morning practices as well, Charlie, I presume, were you?
Well, I introduced that. We never used to do the morning practices. And Mark White arrived. One of the things I was very keen to do, I thought it was all wrong that the two transmitters, two frequencies, carried the races all day. I thought I was totally wrong. We should split. And Peter was dead against it, but Mark agreed with me and said, yes, I think the VHF should carry the normal programmes and the medium wave will carry the race commentaries, which I thought worked excellent, really.
No. Were you a TT fan, or did it matter not to being a TT? I mean, you were the senior producer at the radio station.
I was bored with it sometimes. You know, it was like watching paint dry. I mean, this fella, he loved it. I remember one afternoon, it was Haywood and Agostini in the senior race, and I fell asleep in the commentary box at the grandstand. I slept right through the race. With all this noise coming, waving past us, and I was...
And I pressure was tremendous.
I used to hate the Southern 100.
Really?
Oh.
What was wrong with that, though?
Oh, they were just going round and round and round and round. Oh, I used to hate that.
Yeah,
I dread it.
You see, Jeff, the people like Charlie and me who aren't really fans of the TT say, well, if you've seen one, you've seen them all.
I can see that. I can do that with other sports, but not the TT. But, of course, I came into the grandstand then and took up in pit lane. That really added excitement in there.
Yeah.
And I was always accused of interviewing the riders in the pit stops.
Yes, you were interfering with them.
And interfering with them. Absolute rubbish. I never, ever did it. I just put the mic there. And if they talked, that was fine. And they would be shouting at the mechanics. And sometimes we got words we didn't really want.
Ah, yes, because everybody used to say to me, someday he's going to be told on air to go away.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it did happen. But eventually, one or two of the riders began to respond. Like said Nick Jeffries, he came in, having gone round 120 mile an hour, and he would say, this is a bit easier than riding over Rannoch Moor, Well, it actually meant nothing to anybody, really, only the trials riders, because Rannoch Moor is a desolate stretch in the Scottish Six Days Trial, which goes on for 24 miles or something. He'd ridden it, and I'd ridden it. So he said, I'd rather ride round here than Rannoch Moor. And then Carl Fogarty came in and said, have you got the brew on? This is in the middle of the race, like.
Yeah.
And I was quick enough to say, yeah, well, it'll be TT, quick TT brew. I'll have the pot on for the next lap.
What surprised me up there, too, when I was doing it with Chris Carter, I mean, you'd say to them, want you here, 10:45. And I think, they'd turn up, they'd all, you know.
Yeah, the radio mic transformed everything.
Everything,
though,
you know.
Because you had to have, I mean, for the car rally, we were flying 200 yards of cable down from the top of the grandstand down into the rally paddock. And in fact, it got caught up on one of the cars one time.
Yeah.
And Paul Moulton had the cable round his wrist. And he was very lucky, just didn't snap his arm. Luckily, the cable broke at one of its jointing points. It got caught up on the front of a rally car speeding through.
Yeah.
But that cable was from the top of the grandstand right down to way down Nobles Park. Whereas, of course, with the radio mic, you could just go where you want. So you didn't have to have a book and appointment with the riders, you know, for the hairdo at 10:45 and be there or else. You just went to them.
Well, talking about cables, we used to do the hill climb at Dalty Will.
Yeah.
At the top end, we put half a mile of bell wire from one top to the bottom.
Half a mile?
Yes. Huge big drums of cable we got from the civil defence.
Yeah. And occasionally, of course, the equipment wouldn't work at all, despite Ken Ashton's assurances that it worked yesterday perfectly. Sometimes
it worked last year.
Yeah.
And you had these special boxes to transmit before sort of proper radio mics. And I threatened to heave it over the railings into the tide one time at the start of the car rally down by the Jubilee clock, because for about the third successive time it wouldn't work. And then I noticed the tide was out, so I thought, oh, Ken will go down, get it back, and he'll make it work with it tomorrow. So I didn't bother. And at the go-karts in Peel, there was actually a complete breakdown, and I ended up linking up with Manx Radio by standing in the phone box on the spit corner there, which was covered in straw bags, so you could hardly see anything, and you could just stretch the receiver to be able to just put your head outside the box to see the carts coming around the corner. What a caper.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had some fun. We ended up in a greenhouse one time commentating up at Jerby.
Well, we had a talking about the Southern 100, we had a little minivan in that woman's garden, in the front garden, across four ways.
Yeah.
Well, commentary boxes have always been awkward, haven't they? I mean, if you Tyndall, you'll remember doing the Tyndall commentary, trying to crawl up through the grandstand to get into the box for that.
And then like a mountaineer goat trying to get up the ladder to get into it.
Yes.
And with my head for height, so I was finished before I ever started. I only did it once, and that's why.
Yeah. But they would just make do and mend things almost, Charlie.
Oh, yeah, we had no spare equipment.
I mean, they hadn't the money to pay for anything flash, did
they? So what's new?
when the box of Balaf was built every year, it was stripped down, you see. It was in four wall sections and a roof.
Yeah.
And that was split up then. And that would lie in the open air all winter. And when it was put back up with thumb screws, no one ever cleaned it. So you had to take... I made it a thing in our commentary box that we've always took our rubbish home in a plastic bag, because somebody else did it one year and all their stuff from the previous TT was still all lying on the floor of the box, and it was like more or less like commentating in a urinal, really, because it had been lying out at St John's or somewhere and nobody ever brushed it. And you couldn't, in 1978 when Haywood made his comeback, the windows were so dirty that I actually took the whole front window out, took the thumb screws out. It was a lovely night, that's the only way you could do it, took the whole thing out, and we were commentating there as if we were open air.
Right.
The only time Ian Cannell and I fell out was over the commentary box in the Peel Promenade for the Viking Festival, and we lent the box to Roy MacDonald, who promised to have the box the week later for that night. Tune if the box was there, but there was no windows. So Ian turned up, and he used to have his yellow pullover on in those days, and his clipboard and everything. And he said, "Where's the windows?" I said, "Well, we can't find them. We'll have to do without them." "Look here, fella, I'm a professional broadcaster. No windows, no commentary." So I said, "We'll do it on the pavement." "No windows, no commentary." Yeah. 5 minutes to go, MacDonald arrived at the windows and we got them in and got cracking. But he wasn't going to do. He wasn't going to go in that box.
Yeah.
And then we had to go to the pub and borrow the chairs because someone had lost the chairs.
The pre-TD classic down the Southern 100, of course, they didn't think it would last. It was just going to be for 1 year, so they didn't bother having a comedy box at all. And of course, it kept going and it's still going. But for years, I just stood on the pavement and did it with a radio mic.
Really?
And it was one of those things that out of 8 years, six of them were absolutely tippling down.
It was always bad weather for the Southern
100. Yeah, and then they had a caravan one time at Ballabeg, and it was an old knackered thing they got. I don't know where it was, but your feet went through the floor. It was so rotten.
Yes. Happy days then, were they?
So they say, yeah.
But when you look back, we were pioneers, really, weren't we, in the 60s?
Well, actually, it held the race together because it's so important to know who's leading it. Mm. And in the old days, you would send a car around at the end of the race with the people who'd finished first, second and third, their numbers written on the back bumper of the road's open car. Mm. That was the only real way people knew who'd won. Then came Colburn's, then the BBC, then Manx Radio. But of course, Manx Radio was able to do amateur timekeeping, which was very, very good. The O'Hanlon boys were
spot on, weren't they?
Absolutely spot on to the second. And, and now, of course, it's all done automatically by transponders. But it was a great way of keeping people informed. And of course, all the people signalling the riders as to how they were doing all totally depended on Manx Radio.
Yeah, well, of course, the BBC had been covering it, Graham Walker and people, prior to that. When Manx Radio took over, they very soon dropped out, didn't they, the BBC?
Yeah.
Were there any Barneys between them that you remember or not?
No, thing was always a nice enough
Because at
chap.
One time both were doing, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, always a nice enough chap. I mean, we did go into the grandstand and then Murray Walker was next door.
Yeah.
And he was very good. He was very, very capable and worked with us and everything else. He didn't bear a grudge.
And they rebuilt the new grandstand about 86, I think. Manx Radio were allocated totally unsuitable room altogether.
Wasn't it?
And there's like a section of the grandstand where it's got like a bay window. Well, that was the obvious place to put Manx Radio, but oh no, we were stuck in the end anyway. I played L. We got a proper location for the following year.
I remember being in there with Peter Neal, and you did get a view of the riders coming down towards the grandstand from that corner. Otherwise, it would have been useless, really, wouldn't it?
Well, you couldn't see, of course, eventually, because all the trees grew on Glencrutchery Road, and we used to say every year, can't we get the trees lopped? And nobody would ever do anything about it. And when I got to the grandstand, there were people there.
That caused a bit of a row.
Yeah, there was a bloke there actually trimming them, and I got him because I knew him. I said, just go along and knock the front off all the other ones along the bottom of First Avenue, will you? And he said, you'll get me in hot water. I said, no, it's all right. I said, I'll square the corby up. And it was a hell of a row, but at least we could see the bikes coming.
Coming in on some string and a prayer, TT Broadcasting, the early years, recalled by the late Jeff Cannell and Charlie Webster.
Keep up to date with Manx Radio's dedicated motorsport website, motorsport.manxradio.com, your one-stop shop for news, travel, road closures and racing schedules. You can also step into Manx Radio 1368's 60-year motorsport archive, including interviews with your favourite riders, race highlights from yesteryear, and our collection of motorsport videos and podcasts. motorsport.manxradio.com, the home for motorsport on the Isle of Man, from the best biking station in the world, Manx Radio 1368.